This is the Nietzsche Podcast. Quote, "This collection of conversations with Goethe is largely the result of my own natural inclination to take possession of any experience that strikes me as valuable or interesting by recording it in writing. Furthermore, I always had so much to learn, both when I first met with that extraordinary man and also later when I had been with him for many years, and I like to recall what he had said and to note it down so that I would have it there for the rest of my life. But when I reflect on the rich abundance of his observations, which gave me so much pleasure for 9 whole years, and then see how little I managed to get down on paper, I feel like a child who tries to catch the refreshing spring rain in his cupped hands, only to find that most of it runs through his fingers." End quote. That's from Eckermann's preface to his famous work, Conversations with Goethe. It is the work for which Johann Peter Eckermann is chiefly remembered. His legacy is forever tied to that of Goethe, which is a fact that I think Eckermann himself would have appreciated. It's perhaps unfortunate for Eckermann that sometimes this work is even misremembered as a work written by Goethe himself, sometimes even incorrectly titled as Goethe's Conversations with Eckermann, rather than Eckermann's Conversations with Goethe. The significance of this book, while it comes to us in the voice of Eckermann, is that it is a first-hand account of the person Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, undoubtedly the most famous German writer of the 19th century. Goethe's Sturm und Drang novella, The Sorrows of Young Werther, made waves in European literature, rocketing Goethe to fame. His version of Faust remains a classic in the Western canon. Goethe is known for having more or less conquered most of the genres of literature. And in the words of Hollingdale, he exhausted the entire German language with his extensive corpus of poems. For the last 9 years of Goethe's life, his friend, the artist, author, and poet, Johann Peter Eckermann, kept this journal detailing the conversations between the two men. This project began in 1823 when Goethe was 74 years old and Eckermann was 31. The record continues from that year until Goethe's death in 1832 at the age of 82. Eckermann thus spent the entirety of his 30s in the presence of Goethe, who is his personal hero and who was, at that time, an international celebrity. Eckermann admits in the preface, "There are quite considerable gaps in the work." He says that sometimes whole months went by when, quote, "the stars weren't favorable," end quote. This was due to ill health, the affairs of daily life, other demands on his time which prevented him from writing a single line. He accepts this as a matter of fate, for, as he says, a book has its own destiny, which unfolds quite aside from the author's ideal for it. And he says that the careful reader will find inconsistencies in Goethe's thought, that particularly on the subject of poetry, Goethe could be one-sided or self-contradictory at times. But perhaps that's something that we should expect to find in a record of conversations over 9 years. It might even perplex us if we weren't to find such a thing. And importantly, Eckermann fully embraces the fact that the Goethe that we meet in this book is, above all, his Goethe, Eckermann's Goethe, the man that he knew, and that he is recounting from his own perspective. And admittedly, that perspective is one of admiration. And so the book can't be seen as simply an objective biographical work about Goethe. It's inextricably tied to Eckermann. One might forget this at times, as sometimes Eckermann fades into the background of the text. Often he becomes a kind of interviewer, someone who exists in the dialogue simply to coax the thoughts out of Goethe. But this is his stated intention for the text. He made it his personal mission to take hold of these precious memories as they were formed, commit them to writing, and therefore preserve something of the great author as he knew him. And he thanks Providence for allowing him to create this work at all, in spite of the fact that he was unable to capture the whole man, and he says that it was the crowning achievement of his life. Another author of the 19th century, one Friedrich Nietzsche, in his book, Wanderer and His Shadow, section 109, asks, quote, apart from Goethe's writings, and especially Goethe's conversations with Eckermann, the best German book in existence, what German prose literature remains that is worth reading over and over again? End quote. In the same league with Goethe, Nietzsche lists Lichtenberg, Jung Stilling, Adalbert Stifler, and Gottfried Keller. But as this mere parenthetical remark, Nietzsche calls The Conversations with Goethe the best German book. And that means that in spite of the universal acclaim of Goethe's own works, Nietzsche thinks that Eckermann's account of Conversations with Goethe is the best among them. If there's anything I've learned about Nietzsche over the years, it's that he and I share a fascination with learning about the lives of extraordinary people, that the biography of an artist or a thinker is at least as fascinating as their published work. Their life is just as elucidating of their perspective as their consciously articulated philosophy or anything of that nature. So in that spirit, first let's look at who Johann Peter Eckermann was and the background of his life. Eckermann's life is somewhat interesting in light of the fact that his destiny was to have his name associated with Goethe's in the centuries that followed. He's born in the 1790s in a little town near Hamburg on the border of marshland and heath. He was a farm boy in a relatively poor family. He says, quote, our little house was not much more than a shack, with only one room that could be heated and no staircase. You climbed straight up to the hayloft on a ladder that stood next to the front door. End quote. He was the last child of a second marriage, and he did not know his two older half-brothers. By the time he was 12, his elder sisters had moved away. He was raised mostly as an only child and recalls fondly walking from village to village with his father to trade in small goods. He says ribbons, silk, thread, acorns sold by the bucket to the wealthier villagers to feed their geese. He says these days were among the happiest memories of his childhood. But it was shortly after this that the course of his life would change forever. It began when he tried to copy the image of a horse. It was painted onto a pack of tobacco that his father had just purchased and brought home. He says he felt an irresistible urge to copy it. And the activity of drawing the horse, trying to copy every detail of the drawing, just captured the soul of the young Eckermann. And soon he told his parents he wanted to become an artist. Of course, they didn't have the money to send him to an academy, so he attended all the schooling that his parents could afford, and then he got a job as a clerk working for a local judicial officer where he learned to read and write. He then volunteered to fight in the Napoleonic Wars in 1813, what the Germans at that time called the War of Liberation, to free themselves from the French yoke. After the war, he sought out the artist Romberg in Hanover. He says he tied up a rucksack and departed to walk 40 leagues across the heath to reach that city. When he found Romberg, the master warned him that the life of an artist was a hard one. It's difficult to make one's living from one's art. Nevertheless, Eckermann could not be dissuaded, and he began to study and copy his master's work. Eckermann notes that, as any artist will tell you today, hands are hard, and his studies during this time involved perfecting representation of human anatomy. He read Theodor Korner's book of poems at this time called Lyre and Sword and found himself utterly enchanted by it. He felt a deep connection with Korner because both had fought in the War of Liberation. Both had experienced the soldier's life. Eckermann writes, quote, whenever I was exposed to something impressive, I was nearly always profoundly stimulated and inspired to produce something of my own, and so it was with these poems by Theodor Korner. End quote. I think these little details about Eckermann's early life sort of reveal this instinct. He's a man who copies. He begins his interest in the arts by trying to exactly copy the drawing of the horse. He proceeds by learning to copy Romberg's work. He becomes a poet by sort of following the example of Korner. And for his great work, he copies down the thoughts and utterances of Goethe. You know, he wants to hold on to those memories, as he says, and not let them slip through his fingers. And that's the sort of the peculiar characteristic of Eckermann that makes him the perfect person to offer a snapshot of another personality. And it reveals something to us in reading conversations with Goethe. This is the interest of Eckermann. This is the kind of person he is. He's very Apollonian in that respect. He likes to represent that which strikes him as significant and stimulating and inspiring. And so, in any case, it's soon that Eckermann begins writing and printing his own poems. He soon encounters the poetry of Goethe and is deeply moved by it. In Goethe's work, he says that he finds the human heart, quote, in all its yearnings, joys, and sorrows, end quote. He soon gains a voracious hunger for Goethe's works. Quote, I immersed myself in these ballads for weeks and months on end. Then I managed to get hold of Wilhelm Meister, then his autobiography, and then his dramatic works. Faust I read on all of the holidays, initially recoiling from the dark abysses of human nature and depravity that it revealed. I was drawn back again and again by its highly enigmatic character. My admiration and affection grew by the day. These works took over my life, and I thought and talked of nothing but Goethe. End quote. Eckermann managed to find support from a number of different patrons over the years. He stayed with friends, he received financial help from wealthier people who saw promise in this young writer, and he managed through these means to attend grammar school and eventually university. But eventually the time came that his financial support would soon come to an end. He left university in autumn of 1822, and in the year that followed, he went out on a limb and sent Goethe a copy of his poems and a brief resume of his life and education. Goethe responded, and favorably, and Eckermann set out to meet him in Weimar. Once again, he undertook the journey on foot and walked via Göttingen in the valley of Werra. Goethe was the one writer that, over the years, Eckermann said he always looked to as, quote, an infallible guiding star whose pronouncements chimed with my own way of thinking and led me to see things from an ever higher point of view, end quote. The two men finally meet on Tuesday, the 10th of June, 1823, and they became fast friends. From that point onward, Eckermann began journaling about their meetings and conversations, as he describes, and the two bonded to such a degree that, in his later years, Goethe is asking Eckermann to review his earlier poems to tell him which of them ought to be included in a collection that he's compiling. He trusts him to that degree. He says, you know, you're a young man. These are the poems of my youth, and it's impossible for me to be objective about them. You tell me which of these are the ones that I should include in this collection for all posterity. And so what's contained in this work is not just a series of conversations, but it's the story of a friendship and how it develops over the years. Goethe sees a kindred spirit in this younger man. He acts as a mentor to him. He helps introduce him into the circle of artistic minds and high society in Weimar. He helps Eckermann find a place to live there. And by the time Goethe departs the world in 1832, the two are very close. The conversation topics that this book covers run the gamut, from observations about contemporary European politics and culture, critiques of literary critics, aphoristic statements, personal anecdotes. There's no overarching narrative structure. That's probably one of the things that Nietzsche really likes about this book, is that it doesn't have any of that long-windedness or tediousness that Nietzsche saw in other German books. There's no artificial rigor or structure imposed on the work. In some ways, it's a work of autofiction, an attempt to simply and honestly recall a series of events without imposing an artificial shape on the text. And in this way, it strikes me as a very modern example of a literary work. And there's a sense in which Eckermann is less the author of the work than he is more like something like a journalist. It's just sort of a candid look into Goethe's life. But again, there is that perspective that is very admiring and at times, it must be said, borderline idolatrous. Eckermann is not objective, and he doesn't have the pretense of being objective. But I would argue that it is authentic. He never tires of telling us how perfect Goethe is in his bearing, in his physique, in his manner of speaking. And yet behind the veil of Eckermann's praises, we can perceive the figure of Goethe that's very human and very relatable in many ways. As Eckermann notes, there's plenty of mundane or seemingly insignificant interactions and details that are included in his recollections. And he holds that such apparently insignificant things might not be so insignificant when you take them in total, since it's the little details about a person that tell you the most about them. So we learn little things about Goethe's habits, such as the fact that he never eats when it's late in the evening. We learn that he has a ravenous fascination with the natural sciences ever since the time he was a young man, that he would invite the Duke over to discourse on the sciences late into the night. And so I highly recommend this book if you're anything like me and you like a peek, a look into an earlier time and place, this peek into the early 19th century Germany with this larger-than-life figure and all of those little details. That being said, there are some limitations in talking about this in the context of a philosophy podcast. Today, I do intend to focus more on the ideas, and I'm going to be spending less time on those literary aspects or talking about those little character details about Goethe or the prose. And the other limitation is, because there is no overarching narrative to the story, the only way to talk about sections of this work or pick out the important passages is I kind of had to determine on my own what was an important passage. I had to cherry pick, in other words. And I have selected a number of conversations that I think are relevant, where we can see the influence that Goethe had on Nietzsche's thought, or where we learn something very interesting about Goethe and that's relevant, I think, to comprehending his work or sort of his place in the Western canon. But I highly recommend you read this book if any of this sounds interesting, because this episode, even if you listen to the whole thing, it's hard to call it a spoiler because it's such a treasure trove of all these conversations are like little gems of different size and shape and value. And I picked through it on my own, looking for, earmarking as I read it, passages that I wanted to talk about. And at the end, there were way too many. I had to cut it down, and I'm sure this episode will still run very long. But that's all to say, I highly recommend, if you're interested in this, that you pick up this work, because it's definitely underread among English audiences, I would say. So, among the topics of conversation, Goethe waxes philosophical about mankind, about society, about his own poems. He also comments about his friends and fellow artists. He says, for example, that Schiller's philosophical speculations did not benefit him whatsoever. He says that when Byron is, that he's great only as a poet, but that when he attempts to reflect, he's a child. He speaks, but only when pressed by Eckermann, of meeting Napoleon about a decade and a half prior. And there's actually a very funny conversation where Goethe talks about meeting Hegel. But there's also, you'll find quite a few gems in here of Goethe's reflections on his contemporaries, talking about other people. And contrary to that very popular quote that only small minds talk about people, I mean, Goethe is a great mind, and he finds some wonderful points of reflection talking about people, wonderful insights throughout the text here. One of the first conversations between the two, in which Goethe leaves Eckermann with something of great profundity, this takes place that first year of their friendship on Thursday, September the 18th, 1823, in the town of Jena. Eckermann says of this exchange, quote, "Yesterday morning, before Goethe left for Weimar, I was fortunate enough to spend an hour with him again. What he had to say was most remarkable, quite invaluable for me, and food for thought to last a lifetime. All Germany's young poets should hear this. It could be very helpful." End quote. The advice that Goethe gives to Eckermann, I think, is worth considering in light of the fact that Goethe spent all his entire productive life working on the Faust play. So earlier, when Eckermann says that he read Faust over the holidays before he met Goethe, what he means is he read Faust Part 1. Goethe had published the first part of the play many years prior, but he continued to work on Part 2 almost up to the very end of his life. And so Goethe tells Eckermann, quote, "Beware of embarking on a great work. This is the mistake that our best minds make, the very people with the most talent and the fiercest ambition. I made the same mistake myself, and I know what it cost me. There was so much that came to nothing. If I had written everything that I perfectly well could have, it would have filled more than 100 volumes. The present demands its due. The thoughts and feelings that crowd in upon the poet every day need to be put into words, and so they should be. But if your mind is taken up with some great work, nothing else can get a look in. All other thoughts are pushed aside, and you cannot even enjoy the ordinary pleasures of life." End quote. So Goethe's warning here: if you set out to create a magnum opus, it will consume all of your energy, and all of those smaller projects that you might have worked on will fall by the wayside. You know, you might have had a thought or a feeling that would have made a wonderful poem of 8 lines or so, but you didn't write it because all of your focus was on creating this giant great work. It's a huge gamble to embark on creating a great work, a life-spanning work, when you could be creating hundreds of small ones. This is a bit of a funny warning coming from Goethe, who somehow managed to have a life-spanning great work while also writing dozens of other stories and countless poems and running a theater and coming up with a theory of colors and everything else Goethe found the time to work on. But I like this advice, this warning, because it tells us something about Goethe's personality. He feels like he never has enough time. That's what speaks to me out of this. When he's laboring at his Faust, he's thinking of all the things that he could be doing elsewise. He has that restless creative impulse, and maybe that restlessness comes through in the character of Faust himself. But ultimately, this remark, it's only sort of the preamble. It's the first part of the wisdom that Eckermann found so invaluable. Eckermann says that unless he's mistaken, Goethe once advised that the poet only cover small subjects, and Goethe confirms this. Yes, I did say that. But he asks if any of the younger poets ever listen to what old-timers like himself say, and his advice is to write one's poems spontaneously, to write about all of the small things that happen day by day, to write about what presents itself to you, what appears before you in your senses, and to always follow your own instincts. Quote, "The world is so vast and rich, and life so full of variety, that you will never be short of inspiration for poems. But they must always be occasional poems, in the sense that real life must present both the occasion and the material. A particular instance becomes universal and poetic by virtue of the fact that the poet writes about it. All my poems are occasional, being inspired by real life and firmly grounded in it. I have no time for poems that are plucked out of thin air. Don't let anyone tell you that real life is lacking in poetic interest. This is exactly what the poet is for. He has the mind and the imagination to find something of interest in everyday things." End quote. And when, in this conversation, Eckermann tells Goethe of his plan to write a longer poem about the seasons, which would involve verses on the, quote, "occupations and amusements of all the different classes," end quote, Goethe says this is exactly the mistake that he was just telling Eckermann not to make. The problem with these big projects is you spend so much mental energy simply on structuring the work, on imposing an order on your ideas, and if any one part is handled poorly, then the whole thing will be criticized. You know, the literary critics could tear it apart, and you might have had, you know, maybe in your poem about the four seasons, the section you wrote on autumn was wonderful, the section on springtime was a little weak. Well, the critics will just tear down and attack the whole work, whereas if you had let them each live as their own individual occasional poem, as he calls it, you wouldn't have that problem. So just write about what is given in the immediate experience. And Eckermann says that Goethe paces back and forth in the room as he says this, and that, you know, Eckermann nods and he realizes that everything Goethe is saying is correct. And he says he's set aside all such grand projects for the time being and is much happier now, contenting himself with smaller poetic works. Another piece of advice that Goethe gives in the months that follow, on the 29th of October, he tells Eckermann, always date your poems. That way they can serve as a record of your state of mind. And he says that this is very important and that he's learned over the years how useful it is to have a record of one's past thoughts and feelings. In the cold November of that year, Eckermann says that Goethe has fallen ill. He's fallen under the weather. It hurts Goethe a great deal when he coughs. At least that's how it looks. He grabs at his left side in pain whenever his sickness makes him erupt in a coughing fit. Goethe's in his early 70s by this time, and he's sick for weeks. So long that the news of his ill health spreads. Eckermann says that at the theater, people come up to him and they ask him anxiously, is Goethe all right? And Eckermann, for his part, worries about him day and night, about his new friend. But when he finally goes over to see Goethe on November 17th, he seems to be fine. Quote, he looked just the same as when I left him on Sunday, but now his mood was much brighter. End quote. One of my favorite passages in Eckermann's book records a conversation on Tuesday, January 27th of 1824. Goethe was in a reminiscent mood that day, and Eckermann records Goethe as saying, quote, when I look back at my earlier life and middle years and reflect now in my old age, how few of my contemporaries are still left, I always think it's like staying in a spa town for the summer. When you arrive, you make friends with people who have already been there a while and who will be leaving in the coming weeks. It hurts to see them go. Then you embrace the second generation. You live with them a good while and become very attached to them. But eventually they go as well, and you are left alone with the third, people who arrived shortly before you were due to leave and with whom you have no connection at all. People have regarded me as someone specially favored by fortune, and I can't complain or regret the course my life has taken. But if I'm honest, it has been nothing but work and toil, and it is fair to say that I have not known 4 weeks of pure contentment in all my 75 years. It's been like rolling a heavy stone the whole time, lifting it, turning it over, and then having to do it all over again. My memoirs will spell it out very clearly. There were just too many claims on my time and energy, both from others and from myself. My true happiness has come from my poetic musings and writings. But when I think how these have been interrupted, curtailed, and held back by the demands of my official position, had I been able to distance myself more from public life and business affairs and live a more solitary life, I would have been a happier man and would have accomplished far more as a poet. End quote. I love Goethe's metaphor here of the friends and companions that you meet throughout life at different phases of their own lives intersecting, you know, as acquaintances that one makes at a summer resort. And he says that his widespread celebrity, his high position in society, these are obviously good things, but he's aware of the trade-off that one always has to make whatever their path is in life. And like most artists, he prefers solitary poetic meditation to the hustle and bustle of public life, but also like most artists, he always is drawn into the hustle and bustle of public life. And he regrets that his position forces him sometimes to withhold his opinion. In one of the other conversations, he expresses that Schiller was always better than he was at speaking carefully or thinking before he made a public statement of opinion. It's for this reason that Goethe says he was unfairly considered a friend of the powers that be, so-called, because he expressed outrage at the French Revolution. Even though he considers the powers that be to be corrupt, unjust, principally responsible for the revolution, he was still considered a defender of the establishment. Goethe argues that Schiller is more of an aristocrat than he is, but Schiller is known as a friend of the people because he's more careful in his public engagement, a talent that Goethe simply lacks. There is a rhetorical art to portraying yourself in the public eye, we might say, and many artists are terrible at this. And yet you need the approval of the public in order to gain an audience for your art. So Goethe doesn't find fault with fortune. He's grateful for his success, but it does come at a price, and one which has meant that his life has been quite different from the solitude always sought by the natural poet. On Wednesday, February 25th of the same year, Goethe and Eckermann are chatting while the two of them leaf through some freshly delivered French newspapers. There was a French military campaign underway in Spain, and soon Goethe's thoughts turned backward to the history that he's lived through, and he says, quote, "I have had the great advantage that I was born at a time when the most momentous world events were taking place, and these have continued to occur throughout my long lifetime. I am a living witness to the Seven Years' War, of the separation of America from England, of the French Revolution, and of the whole Napoleon era, with the downfall of that hero and the events which followed. Consequently, I have arrived at very different conclusions and insights to those available to anyone born after now, who will have to learn about those great events from books that he doesn't understand. What the next years will bring, I cannot predict, but I fear we shall not soon have repose." End quote. It's often said that it's a curse to wish for someone to live in interesting times, but for Goethe, he says it's been a great advantage. For an artist, of course, it is an advantage. These remarkable events provide you with incomparable inspiration. In Goethe's case, it's inspiration for all his characters, his plot lines, his poetry. And remember what Goethe said earlier about writing based on what is given to you, based on what you actually see, feel, and experience. Goethe actually met Napoleon, something that Eckermann asks him about numerous times throughout these conversations. He says in 1826, for example, when Eckermann asks him if Napoleon looked different in some way or appeared special in some way, Goethe plainly answers, "He was special." He often seems dismissive of petty politics, especially of partisan politics, but Goethe recognizes these great historical and political happenings of the utmost importance. He's lucky for having lived through them. Goethe's reflections on his meeting with Napoleon are fairly interesting. They're exemplary of the repeated themes and tone of the text. Goethe met Napoleon in 1808 when the newly crowned French emperor came to Germany to hold talks with the Tsar of Russia. Napoleon's troops had conquered Prussia 2 years earlier in 1806, and Napoleonic troops had in fact broken into Goethe's house and those of his friends and colleagues as they sacked Weimar. But by 1808, Goethe had come to see Napoleon as a sort of legitimate successor to the rulers of the Holy Roman Empire. Napoleon, during this summit held with the Tsar, invited Goethe to meet with him. And this was part of what one could accurately describe as a propaganda campaign on behalf of Napoleon to establish himself as the new patron of the arts and to associate himself with the German intelligentsia, many of whom were internationally renowned at the time. But it wasn't solely a cynical propaganda campaign. Napoleon had read The Sorrows of Young Werther many times. Apparently he carried a copy of it with him on his campaigns. Werther is the archetypal Sturm und Drang novel, a tale of the storm and stress of youth, a tumultuous, tortured romance. The story involves a love triangle, and the main character, Werther, resigns himself to the fact that he cannot have the love of his life, Charlotte. He sends a letter to Charlotte asking for a pair of pistols under the pretext that he's going on a journey and will need them. And of course, he instead uses them to commit suicide. The psychological implications for Napoleon's fixation on this story are myriad. And when Eckermann reminds Goethe of this meeting and conversation with Napoleon, he asks about this book. Quote, "I reminded him of his conversation with Napoleon, of which I knew by the sketch amongst his unpublished papers, which I had repeatedly urged him to give in more detail. Napoleon, said I, pointed out to you a passage in Werther, which appeared to him which it appeared to him, would not stand a strict examination, and this you allowed. I should much like to know what passage he meant. Guess, said Goethe, with a mysterious smile. Now, said I almost think it is where Charlotte sends the pistols to Werther, without saying a word to Albert, and without imparting to him her misgivings and apprehensions. You have given yourself great trouble to find a motive for this silence, but it does not appear to hold good against the urgent necessity where the life of a friend was at stake. Your remark, returned Goethe, is really not bad, but I do not think it right to reveal whether Napoleon meant this passage or another. However, be that as it may, your observation is quite as correct as his. I ask the question whether the great effect produced by the appearance of Werther was really to be attributed to the period. I cannot, said I, reconcile to myself this view, though it is so extensively spread. Werther made an epoch because it appeared, not because it appeared at a certain time. There is in every period so much unexpressed sorrow, so much secret discontent and disgust for life, and in single individuals there are so many disagreements with the world, so many conflicts between their natures and civil regulations, that Werther would make an epoch even if it appeared today for the first time. You are quite right, said Goethe. It is on that account that the book to this day influences youth of a certain age as it did formerly. It was scarcely necessary for me to deduce my own youthful dejection from the general influence of my time and from the reading of a few English authors. Rather was it owing to individual and immediate circumstances which touched me to the quick and gave me a great deal of trouble, and indeed brought me into that frame of mind which produced Werther. I had lived, loved, and suffered much. That was it. End quote. So ostensibly the section, this conversation begins with Eckermann's expression of interest in Goethe's conversation with Napoleon. But notice how Goethe wishes to remain discreet about this. He holds his tongue about what Napoleon said about the sorrows of young Werther. And somehow he manages to make this charming rather than disappointing. We may note that Eckermann's mode of questioning here is far from interrogative. I mean, if one wanted to be uncharitable, you could say he's borderline sycophantic. Meanwhile, Goethe is perfectly willing to accept such remarks about himself. We'll simply say, yes, you're quite right, when somebody is speaking of his greatness. So this is the kind of dynamic, the kind of interaction that's common throughout these conversations that I think just bears pointing out. But I don't find it to be a detriment to the work. I think it works in its favor. Eckermann and Goethe, in respect to one another, they end up occupying a very clear character role that's not unlike the master and student in the Zen dialogues. We know exactly how they stand in relation to one another, and the way they interact tells us something about them. As for Goethe's opinion on Napoleon himself, it's worth skipping around a bit as regards the dates of these conversations. One of the most fascinating things that Goethe says about Napoleon, which Nietzsche quotes from in The Birth of Tragedy, is found in a conversation that takes place in 1828. In that conversation on Tuesday, March the 1st, Goethe talks about Napoleon as an extraordinary man, as a kind of genius of warfare. Quote, he lived life as a demigod who strode from battle to battle and from victory to victory. It could be said of him that he was in a constant state of inspiration, which is why his destiny shone so brightly. The world had not seen his like before and may not see it again. End quote. And as he's talking, Eckermann says, Goethe's pacing about the room madly, talking almost as much to himself as he is to Eckermann. He says that Goethe's mind was racing and he murmured to himself, occasionally saying things that Eckermann couldn't fully make out. But then he says something in this excited, perhaps somewhat manic state that seems to have had a huge impact on Nietzsche. Goethe describes warfare as a kind of productivity, which is a somewhat strange claim. And you can tell that Eckermann doesn't fully understand what Goethe's getting at, so he asks him, could productivity be a synonym for genius? And Goethe says the two things are very closely related. Genius is productive power. Goethe says, quote, Napoleon was one of the most productive human beings who ever lived. Oh yes, my friend, one doesn't have to write poems and plays to be productive. There is also such a thing as a productivity of deeds, which in many cases amounts to a good deal more. End quote. Further in the conversation, he continues, quote, genius is not genius without the enduring power to inspire productivity in others. It makes no difference what business, art, or profession that one pursues. It's all the same. Whether one proves to be a genius in science, like Oken and Humboldt, or in war and public administration, like Friedrich, Peter the Great, and Napoleon, or whether one writes a song, like Behringer, it is all one, and the only thing that matters is whether the thought, the insight, the deed is alive and has the capacity to live on. End quote. It seems apparent to me that these ideas are spontaneously uttered by Goethe, while he seems to have been in a somewhat hyperactive or perhaps nervous state of mind. But again, this must have had a profound effect on Nietzsche. We can almost see the prefiguration of the will to power idea in these sentences, that behind all of these various occupations in life is a drive, this drive to productivity, here meaning this drive of life which wishes to bring forth something with the capacity to live on. It manifests in various domains of human activity, but all activity is so constituted by this underlying genius or spirit, we might say. And significantly, he ties the idea of a productivity of deed directly to the example of Napoleon, a figure who had become very important to Nietzsche for the same reason. It's an expansion of the idea of power into something far more broad than mere application of force, into something creative, and then at a higher level of analysis, seeing this productivity, this creativity, even in power when it's wielded in the form of applying force. So both expanding the idea of this sort of genius of life and also seeing that genius of life in power and perhaps what you might call the brute sense of power. As for Goethe's own opinions when it comes to politics, his positions are as multifaceted as the man himself. We already mentioned he opposed the revolution in France without supporting the nobility. He embraced Napoleon, even though he was a product of that revolution. And even though his soldiers had probably caused great inconvenience for Goethe, his remarks regarding political debates sometimes suggest a rather typical 19th century view of power politics, such as when he muses, quote, the liberals may speak, for when they are reasonable, we like to hear them. But with the royalists who have the executive power in their hands, talking comes amiss. They should act. They may march troops and behead and hang. That is all right. But attacking opinions and justifying their measures in public prints does not become them. If there were a republic of kings, they might talk. End quote. So Goethe's point here, he has a distaste with authoritarians who cloak their arguments in virtue, when they claim that their exercise of power is based on what is morally right. Such people shouldn't argue. It doesn't become them. It's insulting to all parties involved that we should have to hear the self-serving, moralizing arguments that comes from the mouths of people who have all the political power. If they want to exercise that power, they should just do it and be honest about what they're doing. Let those who believe in democratic government and self-determination make the moral arguments. Those are the only ones who have a right to make arguments. But even as this is a sort of an implicit criticism of the royalists, Goethe goes on to say, immediately afterward, quote, for myself, he continued, I have always been a royalist. I have let others babble and have done as I saw fit. End quote. And yet, in spite of that sentiment, Goethe makes it clear he actually abominates absolute, unchallenged authority, saying, quote, I was as little a friend to arbitrary rule. End quote. And he also says, he doesn't consider himself opposed to the people. He recommends that Eckermann read Egmont because, quote, I know no German peace in which the freedom of the people is more advocated than in this, end quote. With nuanced opinions such as these, one might be liable to agree with Goethe that he's not, he does leave himself open to being misinterpreted, because any one of these statements taken on its own could lead somebody to have a very different interpretation of what Goethe's politics were. Goethe clarifies, quote, In religious, scientific, and political matters, I generally brought trouble upon myself because I was no hypocrite and had the courage to express what I felt. I believed in God and in nature and in the triumphs of good over evil, but this was not enough for pious souls. I was required to believe other points which were opposed to the feeling of my soul for truth. Besides, I did not see that these would be of the slightest service to me. It was also prejudicial to me that I discovered Newton's theory of light and color to be an error, and that I had the courage to contradict the universal creed. I discovered light in its purity and truth, and I considered it my duty to fight for it. The opposite party, however, did their utmost to darken the light, for they maintained that shade is a part of light. It sounds absurd when I express it, but so it is, for they said that colors, which are shadow and the result of shade, are light itself, or, which amounts to the same thing, are beams of light broken now in one way, now in another. Goethe was silent, while an almost ironical smile spread over his expressive countenance. He continued, "And now for political matters. What trouble I have taken, and what I have suffered on that account, I cannot tell you. Do you know my Aufgeregten?" "Yesterday, for the first time," returned I read the piece, in consequence of the new edition of your works, and I regret from my heart that it remains unfinished. But, even as it is, every right-thinking person must coincide with your statements." "I wrote it at the time of the French Revolution," continued Goethe, "and it may be regarded in some measure as my political confession of faith at that time. I have taken the Countess as a type of the nobility, and with the words which I put into her mouth I have expressed how the nobility really ought to think. The Countess has just returned from Paris. She has there been an eyewitness of the revolutionary events, and has drawn, therefore, for herself, no bad doctrine. She has convinced herself that the people may be ruled but not oppressed, and that the revolutionary outbreaks of the lower classes are a consequence of the injustice of the higher classes. I will, for the future," says she, "strenuously avoid every action that appears to me unjust, and will, both in society and at court, loudly express my opinion concerning such actions and others. In no case of this injustice will I be silent, even though I should be cried down as a democrat." End quote. And so Goethe seems to advocate for a benign aristocracy. The interesting idea here, though, is that the aristocracy is the cause of the revolutions that happen against it. You can say that this is perhaps the type of claim that is not so unusual in a world that is full of Marxian analysis, but Nietzsche makes the same point around his Human All Too Human period and around the time of the Gay Science also. And so even though he goes on to have a very different idea about what the aristocracy should be like, at least this notion seems to have been at least potentially inspired by Goethe. Or at least he seems to have been of one mind with Goethe on this point, that it is the lack of virtue on the part of the nobility that causes such social upheavals. And so Goethe says he always finds himself at odds with the consensus opinions on any given topic. He's always too idiosyncratic. He's always staunchly nonpartisan in his commitments. This even applies to religion. He considers himself a pious man, but he simply does not show it in the way demanded by the religious moralists. There's an amusing bit of conversation concerning these religious types. It concerns the poet Christoph August Tiege, who wrote a poem called Urania. This poem was inspired by both the ethics of Kant and Tiege's faith in the immortality of the soul. Goethe says, quote, "I have had to endure not a little from Tiege's Urania, for at one time nothing was sung and nothing was declaimed but the same Urania. Wherever you went, you found Urania on the table. Urania and immortality were the topics of every conversation. I would by no means dispense with the happiness of believing in a future existence, and indeed would say, with Lorenzo de' Medici, that those are dead even for this life who hope for no other. But such incomprehensible matters lie too far off to be a theme of daily meditation and thought-distracting speculation. Let him who believes in immortality enjoy his happiness in silence. He has no reason to give himself airs about it. The occasion of Tiege's Urania led me to observe that piety, like nobility, has an aristocracy. I met stupid women who plumed themselves on believing, with Tiege, in immortality, and I was forced to bear much dark examination on this point. They were vexed by my saying, I should be well pleased if, after the close of this life, we were blessed with another, only I hoped I should hereafter meet none of those who had believed in it here. For how should I be tormented? The pious would throng around me and say, were we not right? Did we not predict it? Has it not happened just as we said? And so there would be ennui without end, even in the other world. This occupation with the ideals of immortality, he continued, is for people of rank, and especially ladies who have nothing to do. But an able man who has something regular to do here, and must toil and struggle and produce day by day, leaves the future world to itself, and is active and useful in this. Thoughts about immortality are also good for those who have not been very successful here. And I would wager that, if the good Tiege had enjoyed a better lot, he would also have had better thoughts. End quote. The influence on Nietzsche here, I think, appears once again in that last sentiment that Goethe expresses. Unlike atheist philosophers, Goethe is quite willing to believe in a life after this one. He even thinks such a belief can perhaps be life-affirming in its way. But the obsession with such an idea, a constant turning of one's thoughts to immortality, turning towards eternity, seems to Goethe to indicate nothing more than a dissatisfaction with one's own life as they live it. It's better to be silent in one's happiness if you truly believe in immortality of the soul. And the constant chattering on about it reveals perhaps some deep-seated insecurity or a desire to chastise others or scare others, put oneself above others. Those who talk the loudest have the faith that is the weakest, and the adherents of Tiege are therefore suspect to Goethe on that very basis. But here we have that idea that the circumstances of one's life are the source of their philosophical or poetical musings, contained in that powerful aphorism, if Tiege had enjoyed a better lot, he would have also had better thoughts. He's the avatar of this inner uncertainty. The truly pious man is the one who keeps silent, who has recourse to their own inner strength, their own inner faith. And I should also say, it's hilarious to me. I love the sentiment, heaven would be spoiled by the I told you so's of so many moralists and busybodies. You know, suppose that all the preachers of life after death would in fact be there. If I have to spend an eternity with all of them, would it even be worth it? In January of 1825, Eckermann records an interaction between Goethe and an Englishman who's referred to as Mr. H. Mr. H is fluent in German, or fluent enough. The two men discuss languages for a while, with Goethe saying he's long known English because of the English literature that he wanted to read. The newfound English fascination with German literature is a wonderful thing. Mr. H says that while his own German is good enough to understand it when it's spoken, he can convey basic information. The moment he tries to express some philosophical thought, he finds the challenge insurmountable. And Goethe tells him not to worry about this. It's difficult enough to express philosophical thoughts even in one's mother tongue, which is a sentiment I also love. Mr. H then tells Goethe that he's reading Goethe's books, and he asks which ones, and when Mr. H tells him that he's reading Faust, quote, Goethe laughed at these last words. Really, said he, I would not have advised you to undertake Faust. It is mad stuff, and goes quite well beyond all ordinary feeling. But since you have done it of your own accord without asking my advice, you will see how you will get through. Faust is so strange an individual that only few can sympathize with his internal condition. Then the character of Mephistopheles is, on account of his irony, and also because he is a living result of an extensive acquaintance with the world, also very difficult. End quote. And perhaps it's further evidence that Faust is, like, I mean, it's a play, but it reads like a modern novel, in my opinion. And maybe this is further evidence of that, because I don't agree with Goethe's sentiments at all. I find Faust to be deeply relatable. I even find Mephisto to be a fairly likable character. And I don't think it's difficult to see the appeal of those characters. Again, I think this just might be an artifact of the time, because we're all used to like anti-heroes and anti-villains and all of these main characters with this sort of nuance to them that perhaps was a bit more strange in Goethe's time. But, you know, maybe we could say that Faust wouldn't be fully understood for a century or two now that, you know, Faust's restless striving for knowledge and experience and happiness seems quite apropos to our own existence. That being said, I can't really quarrel with Goethe that Faust is mad stuff, especially the Walpurgisnacht and the section known as the Helena. I can't help but wonder if Goethe thought that the mind of an Englishman simply wouldn't know what to make of such hallucinatory style scenes. Mr. H leaves, and Eckermann asks Mr. H on his way out what he thought of Goethe. And Mr. H says that even though he sometimes was condescending, he was never offensive to him, always the great man in everything he did. Somehow, Goethe had a kind of magnetism that allowed him to always get away with dominating the conversation and making himself the center of attention, you know, accepting praise about his work without any humility and so on. If we're to believe Eckermann, Goethe was never the worse for it in the eyes of the social circle. He just had that magnetism. Although perhaps there's, you know, perhaps there's some of that English impoliteness wrapped in politeness in the words of Mr. H. We'll never really know what the tone of voice or body language was in this interaction. All we have is the words. But anyway, Mr. H departs, and Goethe and Eckermann continue talking about Faust. Byron had suggested that Goethe had pilfered elements of his poems when writing Faust. And indeed, both Byron's works and Goethe's exist within that similar aesthetic, the Hellenistic style, which is typical during this romantic period. Goethe argues that Byron is being foolish in these kinds of claims, though, and that the true source of poetry comes from within, from the sentiments and experiences which are common or recurring to all men in all ages. That poets touch on the same themes and revisit the same styles because they are eternally appealing to us, eternally relevant to us, these themes and styles and leitmotifs that we're always returning to. Quote, "The world," said Goethe, "remains always the same. Situations are repeated. One people lives, loves, and feels like another. Why should not one poet write like another? The situations of life are alike. Why then should those of poems be unlike?" End quote. And then skipping further in the conversation, he says that Byron, quote, "knows not how to help himself against the stupid attacks of the same kind made upon him by his own countrymen. He ought to have expressed himself more strongly against them. What is there is mine, he should have said, and whether I got it from a book or from life is of no consequence. The only point is whether I have made a right use of it. Walter Scott used a scene from My Egmont, and he had a right to do so. And because he did it well, he deserves praise. He has also copied the character of My Mignon in one of his romances, but whether with equal judgment is another question. Lord Byron's transformed devil is a continuation of Mephistopheles, and quite right too. If from the whim of originality he had departed from the model, he would certainly have fared worse. Thus, my Mephistopheles sings a song from Shakespeare, and why should he not? Why should I give myself the trouble of inventing one of my own when this said just what was wanted? If, too, the prologue to my Faust is something like the beginning of Job, that is again quite right, and I am rather to be praised than censured." End quote. So just a fecundity of ideas in this. You know, even though he's talking about sort of the specific Byron claim that Goethe may be pilfered from him, whereas other people accuse Byron of pilfering from, you know, other sources, Goethe is expressing the opinion, this is all the common property of humanity. There's sort of an attitude that we also find in Emerson here, right? That you could read into this. Emerson and his idea of the oversoul made similar kinds of claims about the universality, the archetypal nature of human existence, that all of us are expressions of a great oneness that sort of unites all of humanity. All the great lives throughout history are all also our own lives. The same narratives and characters recur again and again. And there's another one of those ideas that perhaps we can see coming through in Nietzsche once more. And maybe not strictly the eternal recurrence, right? We might think of that line much earlier than the creation of that idea in Nietzsche's essay on the use and abuse of history for life, where he simply says, I'm paraphrasing here, but he says that given all the great minds throughout history, the great lives throughout history, all the great events that have ever happened, what could 10 more years teach us that the whole of history has not already taught us? Perhaps more interesting, though, are Goethe's concrete observations rather than general musings. He admits outright, Mephisto sings a song from Shakespeare, and that in the scene of the prologue, we find an obvious allusion to the Book of Job. These stories are not to be regarded as the intellectual property of one author, but again, they're expressions of the common experience of mankind. The one who rearticulates them has just as much right to these ideas, supposing they're doing so authentically, supposing it is actually expressing something that was in their experience, which is common to all mankind. We might also think of Michel de Montaigne's essay where he says that if I come to the same position or the same idea of Xenophon or Plato, they will no longer be his ideas, they will be mine, because I have I have the right to that idea just as much as he does. One of my favorite conversations in the book takes place on Wednesday, October the 15th of 1825. Quote, "In criticism especially, this defect produces mischief to the world, for it either diffuses the false instead of the true, or by a pitiful truth deprives us of something great that would be better. Till lately, the world believed in the heroism of a Lucretia, of a Mucius Scaevola, and suffered itself by this belief to be warmed and inspired. But now comes your historical criticism, and says that those persons never lived, but are to be regarded as fables and fictions, divined by the great mind of the Romans. What are we to do with so pitiful a truth? If the Romans were great enough to invent such stories, we should at least be great enough to believe them. Till lately, I was always pleased with a great fact in the 13th century, when the Emperor Friedrich II was at variance with the Pope, and the north of Germany was open to all sorts of hostile attacks. Asiatic hordes had actually penetrated as far as Silesia, when the Duke of Liegnitz terrified them by one great defeat. They then turned to Moravia, but were here defeated by Count Sternberg. These valiant men had on this occasion been living in my heart as the great saviors of the German nation. But now comes historical criticism, and says that these heroes sacrificed themselves quite uselessly, as the great Asiatic army was already recalled and would have returned of its own accord. Thus is a great national fact crippled and destroyed, which seems to me most abominable." After these remarks on historical critics, Goethe spoke of another class of seekers and literary men. "I could never," said he, "have known so well how paltry men are and how little they care for really high aims, if I had not tested them by my scientific researches. Thus I saw that most men care for science only so far as they get a living by it, and that they can worship even error when it affords them a subsistence." End quote. I think this passage is explanatory of why Nietzsche would say in his Twilight of Idols that Goethe is a sort of exemplar of the Dionysian character in the modern age. That Goethe expresses something in this passage that could only be called a kind of self-reflective romanticism. And this is one reason why Goethe is known as a figure who blends the classical and romantic spirit, because he's both artist and thinker. He's the irrational creative and the man who uses rationality to understand himself, to understand his creative drives. He sees the virtue in error. But just as Nietzsche said that the Greek drama was ultimately Dionysian in its nature, even though it blends Apollo and Dionysus, Goethe is also ultimately Dionysian, even though he also employs that Apollinian self-reflection. But he uses it in the service of romanticism, is the point. Because for Goethe, the mere appearance is in fact more important than the truth. It's more important to believe in the myth of, you know, the Count of Sternberg as the man who turned back the Mongolian invaders than it is to accept the measured, nuanced, complex historical perspective that they were inevitably turned back anyway by circumstances that were out of anyone's control. The defense of Europe, can't be attributed to the glory of a few battles or a few heroic figures. Goethe is saying, we need this romantic history. We need these heroic figures, even if history actually is more complicated than that. That mere appearance is actually more important than people might give it credit for. It's more important than your complex, rigorous historical criticism. The ideal that is created by such a powerful illusion is something valuable. And, you know, this overly developed desire for objective truth will disenchant us with that ideal. And it's, again, worth thinking about Nietzsche's early essay on the use and abuse of history for life, in which Nietzsche outlines three uses for history: the antiquarian, the critical, and the monumental. For the antiquarian, history is a series of inherited traditions and customs, which are sort of adhered to as a way of life. For the critic, history is a thing to use to challenge the status quo. But for the monumental view of history, Nietzsche says, we find inspiration or motivation by looking to exemplars from the past that spur us on to live our lives more fully. And I've often used in my own life the examples of Byron or Emily Bronte or Percy Shelley, these British literary figures who gained greatness at a young age and died before they even reached 30. I often think of them and compare myself to them and consider how they didn't even have as much time as I've had in this life, and yet they managed to make an imprint on the entire legacy of Western literature. And so their example helps me realize, like, every year I have is a precious year. Nietzsche's example is good for that as well. A lot of these figures are. So Goethe's implicit premises in these remarks are that history ought to be a useful thing. But the pursuit of history from the standpoint of the objective truth of historical events might actually serve to diminish one of these uses of history. And so Goethe is expressing a sort of irrational position, but maybe from another perspective, you could say that it's sort of like rational romanticism. Goethe says later in the same conversation, quote, we should only utter higher maxims so far as they can benefit the world, end quote. And, you know, it's worth bringing in that where Nietzsche quotes him at the beginning of Use and Abuse of History for Life. Nietzsche quotes Goethe saying, quote, moreover, I hate everything which merely instructs me without increasing or directly quickening my activity, end quote. In other words, knowledge, truth, this is useful to the extent that it facilitates action, that it inspires creativity or greatness, that it furthers life, that we have a real need of heroes like Mucius Scaevola or Lucretia, and that the desire to deconstruct and tear down such figures, make the individual insignificant in the face of grand historical forces, could actually be deeply harmful, regardless of the question of its objective truth or falsity. And meditations like this one not only have that clear imprint on that early essay of Nietzsche's, but we can see how these same considerations would sort of continue throughout Nietzsche's entire work. Goethe's criticism, therefore, that most men care about the sciences only to the degree that it profits them, I think could be seen as applying to himself as well. I mean, it would have to, right? He's saying that an objective view of history does not advantage us. Then he's like every other man, willing to part with the objective truth for the sake of that advantage. Goethe, once again, is a romantic who's self-aware of what that implies. He lives in mere appearance and in the understanding that he's doing so. But he believes that there's perhaps something more valuable than truth in the objective sense. Again, what we could call activity or life. On Thursday, January 18th of the year 1827, Goethe makes some remarks on freedom. Quote, freedom is an odd thing, and every man has enough of it if he can only satisfy himself. What avails a superfluity of freedom which we cannot use? Look at this chamber and the next, in which, through the open door, you see my bed. Neither of them is large, and they are rendered still narrower by necessary furniture, books, manuscripts, and works of art, but they are enough for me. I have lived in them all the winter, scarcely entering my front rooms. What have I done with my spacious house and the liberty of going from one room to another, when I have not found it requisite to make use of them? If a man has freedom enough to live healthy and work at his craft, he has enough, and so much all can easily obtain. Then all of us are only free under certain conditions which we must fulfill. The citizen is as free as the nobleman when he restrains himself within the limits which God appointed by placing him in that rank. The nobleman is as free as the prince, for if he will but observe a few ceremonies at court, he may feel himself his equal. Freedom consists not in refusing to recognize anything above us, but in respecting something which is above us. For by respecting it, we raise ourselves to it, and by our very acknowledgement make manifest that we bear within ourselves what is higher, and are worthy to be on a level with it. I have in my journeys often met merchants from the north of Germany who fancied they were my equals if they rudely seated themselves next to me at my table. They were, by this method, nothing of the kind, but they would have been so if they had known how to value and treat me. End quote. I wanted to look at this passage for a couple reasons. One of them is that Goethe's expressing sort of this idea about the nobility of the spirit, which is an idea that Nietzsche's friend Meta von Salis would also express, that someone who so thoroughly and authentically commits to their role in society has freedom, not in spite of the restraints placed on them, but because of that. We might consider all of the philosophers who have written about freedom and made freedom central to their work. Kant is concerned with how we can regard ourselves as truly free agents. Hegel sees history as a long struggle with the goal of freedom at the end. Nietzsche orients his philosophical approach around the figure of the free spirit. They all saw freedom differently from one another. But we might notice a commonality in all three. Freedom is not found in the limitless arbitrary whim, but within limits. Whether those limits are moral duties or dialectical relations or what fate has handed to us, there's a sense in which one finds freedom by accepting and committing to what destiny has given to them in life. And so even though you could see some reactionary social views in that passage, certainly, it's fascinating as an intellectual genealogy of where we might see the influence of that idea on Nietzsche as well. And another thing about that is that Goethe is very German, you could say, in this respect, that finding freedom within limitation is a very German idea. Another character trait, which paradoxically is very German, is that Goethe is also a great critic of Germany, which many Germans seem to be. Goethe describes the Germans as Philistines, and he says that they just cannot help but be otherwise. There's a sense in which a truly German culture is still a relatively young thing, and there's a way in which it's a mistake to see the Holy Roman Empire as a quote-unquote German state, because that empire was in many ways multinational. Its state power was so distributed and complex. The distinct German national identity in the modern sense hadn't really been formed, and the Germans sort of seem sophomoric in comparison with the cultures of other European nations. Quote, "We Germans are of yesterday. We have indeed been properly cultivated for a century, but few centuries more must still elapse before so much mind and elevated culture will become universal amongst our people that they will appreciate beauty like the Greeks, that they will be inspired by a beautiful song, and that it will be said of them, it is long since they were barbarians." End quote. So, Goethe is a Hellenist. We see another element in his thought that would later be picked up by Nietzsche, the natural contrast between the culture of the Greeks and the culture of the Germans, always with this implication that it's an unfavorable comparison for the Germans, that they stand for the Philistine par excellence, the opposite pole of culture from the Greeks, who are the perfection of culture. The tension between what is Greek and what is German seems to have preoccupied many of the major German writers throughout the 19th century, in fact. In spite of Goethe's self-assuredness, he sometimes admits to nagging feelings of self-doubt, which may be familiar to many of us, even those who have not written the definitive literary works of an entire language. Just as all of us mortals stand in this shadow of monumental figures and wonder if we'll ever have any ghost of a chance of approximating their greatness, Goethe too felt the same way. Eckermann records an exchange from 1829, Sunday, December 6th. Goethe was finishing Faust around this time and had just shown some of the newly finished scenes of Faust's second part to Eckermann, as he's done multiple times over the past year. Then, as often happens, their thoughts turn to more profound ideas, and Goethe says, quote, "In the East, there was actually a man who every morning collected his people about him and would not go to work till he had commanded the sun to rise. But he was wise enough not to speak his command till the sun of its own accord was really on the point of appearing." Goethe remained a while absorbed in silent thought. Then he began as follows. "When one is old, one thinks of worldly matters otherwise than when one is young. Thus I cannot but think that the demons, to tease and make sport with men, have placed among them single figures which are so alluring that everyone strives after them, and so great that nobody reaches them. Thus they set up Raphael, with whom thought and act were equally perfect. Some distinguished followers have approached him, but none have equaled him. Thus, too, they set up Mozart as something unattainable in music, and thus Shakespeare in poetry. I know what you can say against this thought, but I only mean natural character, the great innate qualities. Thus, too, Napoleon is unattainable. That the Russians were so moderate as not to go to Constantinople is indeed very great, but we find a similar trait in Napoleon, for he had the moderation not to go to Rome." End quote. After Goethe says all of this, Eckermann notes what he was thinking in regard to what Goethe had just said. Quote, "Much was associated with this copious theme. I thought to myself in silence that the demons had intended something of the kind with Goethe, inasmuch as he is a form too alluring not to be striven after, and too great to be reached." End quote. And that is, of course, the irony here, that Goethe himself would be exactly that kind of figure, that as Hollingdale argues, in the wake of Goethe, basically every single genre of literature had been conquered, and, you know, that he left those who came after him to gather up scraps after having harvested the whole bounty of the German language himself. And yet even he looks to Raphael, Shakespeare, Mozart as so incomparable that they form this kind of intimidating visage, you know, this monument so towering and immense that to think to equal it is just a terrifying, it's a Herculean task that one feels to be beyond them. At one point in a conversation taking place in 1830, Sunday, March the 14th, Eckermann inquires about Goethe's lack of participation in the political realm, about the absence of political activism in his poetry, his unwillingness to take up arms during the Napoleonic Wars. Quote, "You have been reproached," remarked I, rather inconsiderately, "for not taking up arms during that great time, or at least cooperating as a poet." "Let us leave that point alone, my good friend," returned Goethe. "It is an absurd world, which does not know what it wants, in which one must allow to have its own way. How could I take up arms without hatred, and how could I hate without youth? If such an emergency had befallen me when 20 years old, I should certainly not have been the last, but it found me as one who had already passed the first 60s. Besides, we cannot all serve our country in the same way, but each does his best according as God has endowed him. I have toiled hard enough during half a century. I can say that in those things which nature has appointed for my daily work, I have permitted myself no repose or relaxation night or day, but have always striven, investigated, and done as much, and that as well, as I could. If everyone can say the same of himself, it will prove well with all. End quote. And so again, as much as he complains about the demands of such a life, Goethe nevertheless sought out these responsibilities. He devoted all his time to the production of his art, and he argues, maybe implicitly, this is his activism, this is his politics, simply to be a poet, to serve his civilization, or civilization more broadly, to serve culture more broadly by writing poetry, to convey the heart of his people, that is his patriotism. What more could his country ask of him than to fulfill the destiny demanded of him by his talents, his God-given talents, and the drives within him? He is who he is, and Goethe certainly could not be accused of underestimating himself or his worth. He's more than willing to say, yes, I offered the greatest contribution to German literature. That was my way of supporting Germany. He continues, quote, I know very well that I am an eyesore to many, that they would all willingly get rid of me, and that since they cannot touch my talent, they aim at my character. Now it is said I am proud, now egotistical, now full of envy towards young men of genius, now immersed in sensuality, now without Christianity, and now without love for my native country and my own dear Germans. You have now known me sufficiently for years, and you feel what all that talk is worth. End quote. Goethe concludes that particular talk with a statement that can reasonably be said to have, I think, influenced the conception of the good European. Goethe is the good European incarnate. He's the man for whom culture stands above nations, for whom civilization is a far grander thing than could be the purview of, you know, one ethnicity on account of their blood. Culture cannot bind souls together solely on the basis of having inhabited the same plot of land for generations, nor is it something owned by the state. Goethe says, quote, I have never affected anything in my poetry. I have never uttered anything which I have not experienced and which has not urged me to production. I have composed love songs only when I have loved. How could I write songs of hatred without hating? And between ourselves, I did not hate the French, although I thanked God that we were free from them. How could I, to whom culture and barbarism are alone of importance, hate a nation which is among the most cultivated of the earth, and to which I owe so great a part of my own cultivation? Altogether, continued Goethe, national hatred is something peculiar. You will always find it strongest and most violent where there is the lowest degree of culture. But there is a degree where it vanishes altogether, and where one stands to a certain extent above nations, and feels the weal and woe of a neighboring people as if it had happened to one's own. This degree of culture was conformable to my nature, and I had become strengthened in it long before I reached my 60th year. End quote. On Monday, February 28th of 1831, Eckermann records a very few direct quotes from Goethe, but records the general ideas of what seems to almost be a philosophical lecture on the, quote, ineffable mystery of life in the universe, end quote. Goethe calls this the daemonic, not demonic, but daemonic, a phrase that evokes the benevolent spirits of ancient Greece, the daemon. Socrates had a daemon, which is akin, in his case, to a sort of intellectual conscience. It was his own benevolent spirit, right? So Goethe describes all reality as being akin to, he used the metaphor of a vast painting, a vast canvas of which one cannot easily inspect the entire scene, but must focus on some small aspect of it, some detail or some corner of the canvas. And he says, we're like a layman looking at the most sophisticated work of art, unable to see its brushstrokes or understand the logic of its creation. Religions of all kinds are not given to us by God, but by human beings, which is the only reason why we can even connect with them. Quote, if they were the work of God, nobody would comprehend them, but as they are the work of man, they do not give utterance to the unfathomable, end quote. Eckermann clarifies further in the passage that even as critics have accused Goethe of lacking belief in God, Eckermann believes that Goethe's belief in the unfathomable is the sincere form of spirituality. And he says that Goethe does not share the common man's belief in God. because such a style of belief is simply too small for him. And it's for this reason, Eckermann suggests, that Goethe found affinity with Baruch Spinoza and his pantheist philosophy, particularly during Goethe's younger days. Spinoza's God is often dismissed by theists as, you know, a form of the divine which opens up the door for atheism or agnosticism, a God which is so expansive and so borderless that it basically becomes everything and nothing. And yet, if one takes that contradiction seriously as a kind of coincidenta oppositorum, the complete ineffability of God is really quite striking in that view. It's a more respectful notion of God's ineffability than the pretensions of it, while, you know, that one might get in a church sermon, all while they're depicting iconography, showing the divine. And, you know, indeed, Eckermann records that Goethe thought that the personification of the divine into human form was an indication that the Greek cosmology was of a younger and more naive kind, and that even the Greeks situated the Moira, or fate, over the gods. And thus, you know, that sort of remands the ultimate control over the course of events in the universe to this impersonal force which is set above the personal. Perhaps the most reverent form of devotion to the divine would be to surrender our personifications of the divine entirely and regard something like Spinoza's pantheistic God as the divine. And, you know, on the other side of that coin, whenever somebody tries to conceive or represent all that the divine would encompass, it's always an unaccomplishable task, because you're necessarily trying to represent which is unrepresentable. We might think of Pascal's contemplations about man's position between a nothing and an infinity. That's the unfathomable in Goethe's view, the majesty of the universe in which we find ourselves, it does inspire a sort of reverence. And that's what nature was for Spinoza. And I think that's very, Spinoza's influence, especially on Goethe when he was younger, is very useful to comprehend how Goethe thinks about God. Eckermann writes, quote, "Since the great being that we call the Godhead manifests itself not just in humans, but also in an abundant and powerful nature and in mighty world events, any conception of it formed by analogy with human characteristics is bound to be inadequate, and the attentive observer will soon stumble across shortcomings and contradictions that will plunge him into doubt, if not despair. Unless, that is, he is either small enough to be satisfied with some specious evasion, or big enough to look at things from a higher perspective." Goethe found such a perspective early on in Spinoza, and he joyfully acknowledges how closely the views of the great thinker accorded with the needs of his youth. He saw himself reflected in him, and so was able to refine and develop his own thinking by reading him. End quote. Goethe's world is fueled by a daemonic spirit, strikes me as an innovation on the God of Spinoza, which is itself a sort of innovation or further development based on Bruno's conception of the world soul. And I can't help but think that Nietzsche might have seen something in this conception which might have influenced the idea of the world as will to power. On Wednesday, March 2nd of 1831, Goethe expands on the idea of the daemonic world spirit, and I'm quoting from the conversation in an abridged form, quote, "The daemonic," he said, "cannot be explained by reason or understanding. It does not lie within my own nature, but I am subject to it. Napoleon," I said, "seems to have been daemonic by nature." "He certainly was," said Goethe, "and to a degree that is possibly unique. The Greeks ranked such daemonic beings among the demigods." "Doesn't Mephistopheles," I asked, "exhibit daemonic traits too?" "No," said Goethe. "Mephistopheles is far too negative a being. The daemonic manifests itself in a wholly positive energy. Among artists," Goethe went on, "you find it more in musicians." End quote. A week or so later, on March 8th, after Goethe makes a few more remarks about the demonic as it appears in poetry, saying, for example, that it appeared in Byron, we get the sense that the demonic for Goethe is a concept that indicates creativity, magnetism, and force, but which is inexplicable via means of the intellect. It seems to be at once the conception of the élan vital, Spinoza's natura naturans, and the notion of genius that would later be taken up by Nietzsche and Schopenhauer. Quote, that creative force we call the demonic, I ventured, seems somehow divorced from the idea of the divine. My dear fellow, said Goethe, what do we know of the idea of the divine? And what do our narrow notions of the supreme being signify? If I were to name it with 100 names, like a Turk, I would still fall short, and measured against such an infinity of attributes, I would have said nothing at all. End quote. And so here, I think we have a reference to the Islamic practice of attributing 99 different names or titles to Allah, and the Ottoman Turks at this time are sort of the main representative of the Muslim world to the 19th century European. And so, you know, Goethe says that he, like a Muslim Turk, could ascribe all of these names, all of these descriptors to God, but he would have exhausted none of God's attributes, because an infinity minus 99 is still infinity. We might remember Spinoza's idea that God's attributes are infinite, because God is an infinite being, and that seems to be at play in Goethe's thought here. Although Eckermann does not record the exact date, towards the end of his life, Goethe expands on a sort of Emerson-esque view of a universal culture, a culture which is above and prior to all nations. This conversation occurred sometime in early to mid-March of 1832, and it begins with a discussion of the Moira, which again is the Greek notion of fate. For the Greeks, of course, there was a kind of tragic dimension to the Moira, and Goethe comments upon this and contrasts it with the kind of world feeling that it apprehends in post-Christian Europe. Quote, we talked of the tragic idea of destiny among the Greeks. It no longer suits our way of thinking, said Goethe. It is obsolete and is also in contradiction with our religious views. If a modern poet introduces such antique ideas into a drama, it always has an air of affectation. It is a costume which is long since out of fashion, and which, like the Roman toga, no longer suits us. It is better for us moderns to say, with Napoleon, politics are destiny. But let us beware of saying, with our latest literati, that politics are poetry, or a suitable subject for the poet. The English poet Thomson wrote a very good poem on the seasons, but a very bad one on liberty, and that not from want of poetry in the poet, but from want of poetry in the subject. If a poet would work politically, he must give himself up to a party, and so soon as he does that, he is lost as a poet. He must bid farewell to his free spirit, his unbiased view, and draw over his ears the cap of bigotry and blind hatred. End quote. And what Goethe kind of goes on to say in this conversation is the same kind of sentiment he expressed 2 years prior, that his politics, his patriotism, his contribution to politics is his poetry, nothing more and nothing less. And if he were to make his poetry political, it would make it just simply worse poetry. So, Goethe in his last musings of his life that Eckermann records seems preoccupied with many of these same themes. And in some ways, he is somewhat petty. I mean, he often returns to the unfair ways in which he's been judged by the public, or hated because he refused to join the club of Jacobins, or disdained by the royalists for not becoming politically involved. It seems that Goethe returns time and again to the concern with how he's perceived by others, with his public image, perhaps to an unhealthy degree. And this seems to become more of a fixation as he gets older. Perhaps it's because he's considering his legacy and how he's going to be remembered. And if only he would know that many of these remarks about how he's perceived by the public, not only are they many of these judgments that have been made about him, not relevant at all now in the way that Goethe is remembered. They are only really preserved in the fact that Goethe is talking about them here, that he seems very concerned with them. And so to me, it's actually a very hopeful note about this, that there are so many, you see that the public opinion is this fickle, you know, superficial thing in any age, and all of these sort of accusations that are being made about Goethe, the great man, to try and tear him down, these are all forgotten. And what do we remember? We remember Faust. That's what most people remember about Goethe. But, you know, perhaps we can forgive him for his preoccupation with this, again, insofar as all artists are perhaps unhealthily concerned with their audience, hopelessly entangled with their audience, worried about how they'll be thought of in posterity. And Goethe also frequently returns to these same figures that he brought up before, of Raphael, Shakespeare, Mozart. Those are sort of the three representatives for the greatest in the visual arts, in drama, and in music. These incomparable artistic giants who sort of fill anyone who would dare challenge them with fear in the face of being up to that task. And it's a very human fear or preoccupation to have, but again, one that was not warranted, because Goethe is often listed along with those other names. Again, as there's no narrative structure and no climax to the story, there's no dramatic ending to Goethe's time here on Earth. Eckermann simply records the series of mundane interactions and political and artistic topics of conversation that characterize his final months, just as they characterize the early conversations found in the book. Eckermann tells us, quote, "The last stranger whom Goethe entertained as his guest was the eldest son of Frau von Arnim. The last words he wrote were some verses in the album of this young friend," end quote. Goethe died of heart failure at the age of 82 on the 22nd of March, 1832. Reportedly, his last words were, "More light." Eckermann tells us that on March 23rd, he went to view the body. Quote, "The morning after Goethe's death, a deep desire seized me to look once again upon his earthly garment. His faithful servant, Friedrich, opened for me the chamber in which he was laid out. Stretched upon his back, he reposed as if asleep. Profound peace and security reigned in the features of his sublimely noble countenance. The mighty brow seemed yet to harbor thoughts. I wished for a lock of his hair, but reverence prevented me from cutting it off. The body lay naked, wrapped only in a white sheet. Large pieces of ice had been placed near it to keep it fresh as long as possible. Friedrich drew aside the sheet, and I was astonished at the divine magnificence of the limbs. The breast was powerful, broad and arched. The arms and thighs were full and softly muscular. The feet were elegant and of the most perfect shape. Nowhere on the whole body was there a trace either of fat or of leanness and decay. A perfect man lay in great beauty before me, and the rapture which the sight caused made me forget for a moment that the immortal spirit had left such an abode. I laid my hand on his heart. There was a deep silence, and I turned away to give free vent to my suppressed tears." End quote. Even in death, Eckermann's worship of Goethe does not in the least bit subside. And when he weeps, one can feel his grief even in words that come to us from almost two centuries in the past. In this journal entry, we have the recording of an emotion, of the inevitable and immense pain that Johann Peter Eckermann felt when his friend and mentor, to whom he was deeply attached and deeply indebted, finally departed the world. What we're left with at the end of Eckermann's conversations with Goethe is not, therefore, a story with a moral or a neat conclusion which sums up the character of Goethe or puts him into a neatly defined category. If anything, Eckermann's account continually brings forth new dimensions to this man, new angles from which to consider his life and work. The book is a continual fleshing out, a continual complication, a continual making human of the man which he nevertheless continually portrays as beyond the human, as one of the greatest who ever lived. Even in death, his body is perfect, right? As he tells us in the preface, no matter how many of these conversations that Eckermann managed to record, the true character and spirit of Goethe cannot be truly conveyed, and the majority of his memories of the man will vanish, like gold dust in the sands of time. All he can offer us is the most minuscule inkling of what kind of person he was. Stimulate our imagination, allow us to picture ourselves in the room with the two of them, perhaps as one of the many guests that Goethe entertained, always with great enthusiasm and charm. Eckermann's portrait of Goethe remains endearing because it is a portrait of a friend that he loved, and it is his hope that in reading it and encountering Goethe the man, we might see what was so magnificent about him, even if it's only a faint glint within our own imagination. That's all for this week, everyone. Thank you for joining me. Signing off. If you enjoyed the Nietzsche podcast or found it helpful, you can visit us and support the show at patreon.com/untimelyreflections. The link is in the description. Or just share the show with any of your friends that you think might enjoy it or on social media. Thank you for your support.